Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. This week, we're continuing our interview with Hal Philip, inventor of the modern touchscreen. Previously, we covered several of Hal's earlier inventions, including the creation of the charge transfer sensor. Today, we'll be hearing about how the sensor led to touchscreens as we know them today and what happened in their aftermath. Joining us this week, we have Bradley Norris, director of the Technology Entrepreneurship Program at Baylor University, as well as your trusty host, Robert J. Marks. Enjoy!
So let me ask you, you were recognized by the Queen of England for your business.
That came much later.
Yeah. That was later?
That was much later.
Okay.
Yeah, that was before I sold the company.
Before you sold the company?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you were much bigger than what you were doing now.
Yeah.
Okay, so is it time to go into the touch screen?
No.
Okay, what's next?
So up until this point in time, I was doing single point touch sensors, so single channel, so you touch, you know, or proximity, what, single channel stuff. But I soon realized you could expand it into a linear sensor. So you do a stripe sensor, so you get analog output. So you'd have two sensors on two ends of a conductive strip or some geometric set of electrodes, and you get a ratio of the two endpoints. And so I did that and produced a chip that did that. And then found out that, okay, you can do a scroll wheel like on the iPod, so you could wrap it into a circle, so you can do that. That's three channels of sensing. And then I developed for General Electric in Louisville, Kentucky. They approached me around 1999. They wanted to have touch controls for their Monogram family of appliances, and it was like 60 touch buttons on a cooktop, on a oven, whatever. And so that was a lot of chips, and it wasn't really economical to expand it to that.
What were they trying to do with all these chips? They were trying to do
controls on the stove. Or whatever it was, the micro, whatever it was.
The 20 or 30 controls?
Yeah, well, there's a keypad, there's a, you know, all the cook modes and, you know, all the stuff,
yeah,
right?
Typical
so,
stuff.
A lot. And they got up towards 60 on some of
these.
Wow. There's huge numbers of buttons.
That sounds like something they
custom labeled mode buttons. And
they call it feature creep.
You just get too many features. So the question was, how do you do that with the current technology that I had? And I knew that I couldn't commercially adapt the technology I had to this kind of application. It was a lot of channels of sensing. So I tried to figure out how to make it into a matrix. In a matrix, you have crosswires like this. So you have electrodes that are emitting pulses sequentially. So pulse this one, then this one, this one, this one. And then you have other electrodes that cross. They don't touch, but there's a dielectric in between. And then you're receiving the charge through a dielectric. So you have like a plastic layer or a glass layer in between. And you're receiving charge on these electrodes. And you can differentiate all 16, in this case 4x4, you can differentiate all 16 nodes independently. They're completely independent channels. There's no crosstalk at all. And so that was the basis for the General Electric contract, and that was around 1999. And so I developed that technology, and in fact it was very cheap to produce again. The external circuitry was very minimal, and that was a very successful contract. When I did that contract, I then realized that once you had this XY matrix of sensors, you could interpolate between the two of them, and that gives you a touchscreen. So you just had to have them in a regular arrangement, and you got the individual channel outputs from every crossing. Every crossing generates an output. Even just 8 bits is enough. And then you take the next channels around it, and by using ratiometric analysis, you can figure out where the finger is touching on a two-dimensional surface. So that became another set of patents.
Is that basically the same sort of touchscreen we use today?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, they're all based on the same principle.
But your patent is expired.
Yeah, sadly. But I don't get any money from it now, even since I sold the company. That's another question.
What surprises me about you, Hal, is that once your patent expires, you don't keep track of the technology anymore. You just kind of...
No, I let go.
You let go and
I go on
to the next thing.
Yeah.
So it's always about the adventure of the next step.
Yeah. You want to talk about Apple next?
Talk about Apple, yes. Let's talk about Apple. One of the things that Hal taught me is that when you get a patent is only a license to sue. Nobody else is going to defend your patent at all. You have to. So it's a license to sue.
This, correct.
This is the parable that goes with that saying.
Correct. So if somebody steals your car, you call the police. If somebody steals your patent, you're stuck. You have to pay money, a lot of money, to defend your patent. It's just the way the world works. And that's the dark side of inventions, because if you have a really great idea, people will steal your patent. It's guaranteed. Don't think otherwise. It's absolutely guaranteed. And if you can't defend your patent, if you don't have the resources to defend your patent, the rest of the world would get the message that you're a soft touch, that you're weak. Somebody stole it already. You didn't do anything about it. So everybody's going to steal it. And then you have nothing left. That's the real world. That's the real world. A patent is a license to sue. That's all it is.
So you had license to Motorola, Samsung, GE, and Apple. But then something happened with Apple that raised your eyebrows. Could you go into that?
Well, Apple was one of the first licenses I did with this technology, one of the very first. Hmm. The other cases I was with the capacitor I was really selling, except for the automatic faucets, of course. But in the case of Apple, I was just from a marketing perspective, I was a one-man band, okay? I had a very small company around the year 2000, and I had like five people at that point in time. So I was doing my own sales and marketing, and I was writing articles and so on. So the principal means of marketing was actually writing articles for trade journals. So I'm pretty good at writing, and so at least I think I am. So I would write an article about an application of one of my patents. I would do the drawings. I would have a professional photographer do a very nice photograph. And I would submit it to, for example, Sensors Magazine or Appliance Magazine or any of these commercial trade magazines. And every time I would get on the front cover. The front cover. Well, not buried on page 65. It was the front cover. Why? Because I had a great photograph.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
It was a beautiful photo, abstract. I mean, the photographer I hired was amazing. This is all pre-digital stuff, right? So this is late 90s. And all analog with film and everything, you know, so but did a great job. And I submitted those, and I got on the cover every time. I have so many covers in magazines, I stopped counting.
Wow.
And one of those magazines was read by an engineer at Apple. His name was Chris Craw. And he was working on the G4 Power Cube, which is around the year 2000. I don't know if some of you remember that. It was a box, a cube, a passive radiator, didn't have a fan in it. It was one of Johnny Ive's creations, I guess. And it had a capacitive touch button on it because Steve Jobs had decreed that they would use capacitive touch. It was sexy, it was cool, you know. The problem, as Chris Craw described to me, was that their capacitive sensor cost about $35 and didn't work worth a damn. So when your phone went off next to the computer, it would switch it on and off. You know, if your cat went by, it would switch it on and off. And you know, so not very reliable and horribly expensive. Chris Craw saw my chip. I was selling through distribution at the time, through DigiKey, which some of you may know. And it was a catalog item, along with a bunch of other derivations that I had going through DigiKey. He bought one, and he stuck it in the computer, and it worked first time. And the cost was about $1.50 or something like that. So that's what the retail price was in small quantities. And so I got a call from him, and an invite to come to Cupertino. So I did. I went out there and had a conversation. And it turned out the G4 was quickly discontinued, so I didn't get in there. But Chris Craw went over to the monitors group, and it was decreed then that they would put my chip into their monitors. So, the desktop monitors. And that was just the single point sensor. It was nothing sexy, nothing fancy, just on-off, you know, end menu functions. So the senior buyer for Apple that was involved in this transaction called me and said that they couldn't possibly do business with my company, which was Quantum Research Group, by the way, if you want to look it up. Couldn't possibly do business with us because we're too small. We had maybe 8 people or something. And it was a liability for them. You know, if we went bankrupt, then the supply chain would be disrupted, and you just can't do that. So that's a lesson in business right there. You have to find an alternative means to market if you're too small sometimes. And in this case, I said, well, how about licensing it? Because I knew license models, right? So I said, let's license it. And they said, yeah, we do licensing all the time. We'll license it. So I wrote a license agreement with Apple. So it went into their monitors, and that ran for, I think, 5 years or so. Microchip was selling the actual chips themselves directly to the suppliers in Japan and Korea. I was getting royalties. My company was getting royalties, which was very cool. They got very angry with me, though, because I refused to sign the terms and conditions that Apple laid out. They first signed the contract, the license agreement. Then they presented me the T's and C's after that. And I read the terms and conditions. And I read the terms and conditions and said that I will not work with any competitor for Apple for the rest of my career. And I said, no, I don't think so. Thank you very much. And that made them very angry. Yeah.
Can we go back to they rejected you as a direct supplier.
Yeah.
But were okay with
as
licensing.
A license. Yes, because the supplier was then Microchip directly, which is a Fortune 500 type company.
Right. So did they specify the parameter on which they rejected you? I know supplier evaluation, supplier qualification is a big issue in supply chain management, operations management.
Too small. That's it.
Just too small.
Just too small.
Okay.
Yeah. They just wouldn't work with a tiny micro-sized company.
Okay.
Yeah. That's it.
All right. But they were comfortable with the license.
Absolutely.
And so...
So in my pack of tricks was licensing agreements. So
okay, so how did you get past their terms and conditions?
I didn't.
That were unrealistic.
I just didn't sign them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the manager was fired the next week.
Oh.
Because he screwed up. Okay. He should have presented the T's and C's first.
I see.
Yeah. I know his name. I'm not going to repeat it here.
Okay. But his initials were... No, don't. Don't go there.
Okay. Yeah, that was really something. And so I guess Steve Jobs got really angry with me. So that colored the rest of the relationship with Apple, not in a good way. But I didn't know it had gotten that bad. So when I developed the touchscreen, I took some models to Cupertino. And I met with Johnny Ive and a team of engineers and managers, and again, in a conference room about this size. And they oohed and aahed over it. And I had a private meeting with Johnny Ive afterwards and all that stuff. And I said, yeah, we'll get back to you. And they never did. They never did. And the rest is kind of history. They stole everything from that point on. Everything. There wasn't a patent that I had that they probably didn't steal in some fashion in terms of capacitive sensing at that point in time.
So that's the reputation for some of the larger companies. They use your technology without considering the ownership at all. And then if you get cross with them, you either go to court, and if you don't have the resources, you lose your shirt. If you do have the resources, well, you know, the legal thing plays out. And sometimes they come to you and say, we'll buy your company. We'll give you a few million dollars and we'll just buy your company and, you know, to heck with you. So elaborate on that and what Apple did and what you did in response to that and the idea that patents give you a license to sue.
Sure. So once I realized what they were doing, it was, again, a survival thing that kind of kicked in. Either I sued them or I would lose the company eventually. It's just a matter of time. Because everybody in the industry knew what was going on. They all took apart the Apple products. And I got calls from people. So you got to deal with Apple. No, actually, I don't. Because they knew whose tech was in there. So Motorola, for example. I quickly licensed Motorola when they were still in the handset business. So they got a touchscreen license from me. They didn't develop it to the degree that Apple did later. But around about 2005, I was kind of pleading with Apple, their legal department, to do business with me and to be honest and, you know, all these, to be ethical and all the things they claim to be as a company. My lawyer explained to me that basically companies like Apple, big American companies, are, let's say, they're a little ethically challenged. What they will do is they'll take what they want in the marketplace. They see a good idea, they just steal it. And they just wait for the pennies to drop, you know, see if anything happens after that. So in many cases, if you're a tiny company, you don't have the resources to sue, so it slides by. And eventually, like I said, you lose your company. In some cases, if you think you have the money to sue, you go and sue them, but then you go bankrupt from the legal fees. So they
you have to have deep pockets.
You have to have really deep pockets to sue. And so I was faced with this conundrum. So it took me about a year to figure out whether I, you know, this was the proper course, you know, what the proper course was. And I did sue them in 2006. And the lawsuit involved several things. It involved, first of all, the trackpad on the notebook, which was mine. It involved the iPad, which was mine. Involved the mouse. They called it the Mighty Mouse. It had a capacitive switch in it. That was mine. And the scroll wheel on the iPod. That was mine. They took all those things without permission. Just about everything that I'd done to that point in time was mine. And their attitude was, well, sue us. Okay, so you have to sue them.
So you did.
I did. Fortunately, as a company, we were doing really super well. You know, between license agreements and money coming in from that, money coming in from chip sales, we were really flying pretty high, and we had a lot of cash in the bank. And remember, we had no venture capital. So I ran the company extremely tight, really super tight. And, you know, there was no fluff in that organization whatsoever. We had secondhand office furniture. You know, we were sublending from a company that was slowly going bankrupt and expanding into their space. And so we optimized our rental needs. And so we had the cash. And so 2006 came around and they weren't responding, and my lawyer was saying this, you're not going to get anything out of them. It's like squeezing a rock, you know. So I filed a lawsuit. And in 2007, I spent $3 million just in that year alone on litigation.
On legal fees. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Just in against Apple. 90% of it was against Apple. Wow. We had other lawsuits as well, but that was a major one. And then there was a discovery process. So if you sue somebody in civil court, they have the chance to go through your file cabinets and all your electronic records and everything, and you have to produce these. So you need staff to do all that and produce all these documents and upload them to a cloud storage facility.
But that's discovery. And that's
only, discovery.
That's only in the U.S.,
Yes, it's mostly in the U.S.
Mostly in the U.S.
Yeah. There's some limited discovery in the U.K., but that's U.S. So, but the lawsuit was the U.S., so I had to play by U.S. rules.
Okay.
And so that was very disruptive. All that is very disruptive to your organization. You just, like, all your people are involved in this sideshow, right, that has nothing, no bearing on your actual business. But you have to do it. And it's a bit disheartening, honestly. But we won the Markman hearing. The Markman hearing is where the judge will decide on your claims. And I had something like 20 claims in the dominant patent that they were violating, that the lawsuit was about. And one of the claims was disallowed, only one out of the 20. And so the lawsuit was allowed to proceed to trial. And then the iPhone came out in 2007. So this is the following year. And when the iPhone came out, we opened that up and realized that there was another patent involved. And my lawyer said, well, you're going to have to file a second lawsuit.
Oh, jeez.
And it's like, okay, well, yeah.
And so you did.
No, I didn't. Okay. I decided to sell the company.
Okay.
There comes a point where you know you have to get out. And this is really, really critical. You have to know when to leave. You have to know when you're at your peak and when it's time to go. I woke up one morning and I said, this isn't fun. Just not having a good time. It wasn't about the money. It was just not having a good time. So I made one phone call and I sold the company to my principal supplier, which was Atmel in San Jose. Atmel does the AVR family. They were bought up later by Microchip. There's a really interesting story involving Microchip and Atmel, but that's for another time maybe.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a lot of rivalry. Anyway, I called. I knew the CEO because I'd just done a license agreement with them, so I knew the CEO. And I called him up, and he said, I'll be on a plane as soon as I can, a couple days. Meanwhile, don't talk to anybody else. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. Yeah.
Did he have a cat on his lap?
Yeah. He did. He did.
I know none of us like to spend a lot of money on locks for our doors, but a good defense is necessary, and clearly in this case, you needed to activate those defensive mechanisms like a
sure.
lawsuit.
Yeah.
What was it that triggered you? You said it took a year to decide to go to court. And by the way, you're not the only small business mm-hmm. that has decided to do this. Would be interesting to kind of dig up the various stories. I know Masimo continues to play out with their oxygen sensor and heart okay. rate sensors in the watch. But I'm just curious about that decision, how you came to the conclusion, okay, it's time, we have to activate this, we have to do this.
Well, it was just the fact that they weren't responding. You know, I really did have put in a lot of good faith effort and communication to their legal team and to their management to try to do business with me and mm-hmm. honestly accept a license agreement and pay money. And they were just stonewalling. Mm-hmm. And also, I was looking at the financial situation of the company, the other things the company was involved in at that point. And so it's a kind of a balancing act. It's not just about deciding to sue, but also when to sue and knowing that you have the resources to back it up, right? So if I had run out of cash, if the company had run out of cash during the middle of the lawsuit, then it would have been a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. That what happens next is that you go bankrupt and then Apple, for example, could buy the company out of bankruptcy and get all the patents. It kind of works like that, you know. So it's a very dangerous game. It's really super dangerous. There's no backup plan, really. You either do it or you don't do it. And so I did it. And and we were winning, except that, I would have had to file another lawsuit, civil suit, and go through the discovery process again and pay another $3 million a year and, you know, whatever. And by the way, even if you win the litigation in civil court, that doesn't mean you actually win the whole overall case.
What?
You can win the battle but lose the war. So they can appeal that decision through the appeals process, and it could take you 10 years to get your money, you know, 10, even more. I mean, there's the infamous case of the automatic windshield wiper, which is like a 1960s patent or something, and this went on for like 20 years. The guy got it just before he died. He got the money finally. So, and he got like 20 cents out of the dollar of what he was really owed. So, and the other trick that they will do is, an Apple, for example, or any company in this kind of scenario, might offer you 10 cents on the dollar just to make the whole thing go away. So you think you got something, but actually they got off really cheap. And that just makes the whole thing go away, right? So, but yeah, do you really want to do that? Not really, no.
You know, the case where they had the automatic windshield wiper, they made that into a movie called Flash of Genius.
Did they?
Yeah, and so that's, you know, if you want to watch the story in a pseudo-documentary where actors play out things, it's a good thing to watch. But yeah. It really shows the difficulty of going up against a Goliath when you're a little David, you know?
It's a very amoral business. There's no ethics involved. The company can spout all they want in public about ethics and morality and how they treat small suppliers. It's BS. Well, at the end of the day, they do what they want to do. That's just the way the world works. That's just the way the world works.
So has this changed you, this experience, as an entrepreneur, as an individual? Has living through that attack and defense changed you?
Yeah, I don't want to get back in that business, that's for sure. It was a bit traumatic, you know. So, I mean, I won the battle because the lawsuits went with the company when I sold the company.
Right.
And Atmel picked up all the litigation and settled with Apple, so they did their thing. But meanwhile, I got paid, so I had a really good positive outcome. And since I didn't have venture capital, I basically owned the whole company. I had a stock option program and so on, so, you know, some percentages went to friends and family who supported me in the early days and employees and so on. And that's great, but I didn't have to pay off a VC house, so it was mine, basically. And that was nice. So That was anti-traumatic. That was a good part, right?
Right.
That was a good result. Would I do it again if I knew what I was facing from the very start?
Yeah.
Not so sure.
So what's the vision now?
I'm retired.
Well...
That wraps up part two. We'll be back next week to cover some more of the lessons Hal has learned from his career and answer some questions from the live audience. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.